That actually, at a point that occurs to me on that, Howard, just as we're looking, is do you almost need to get to a stage as one increasingly looks at, there's a concept called zero trust, which is now becoming more and more essential. It's basically do not trust your tech suppliers. And if you want a practical example of why that's so important, just Google Move It hack. Roughly a third of the FTSE companies are currently, coming back to Howard's point about where all the PPI lawyers went, about a third of the FTSE is faking compensation claims from their employees, because basically there was a piece of software called Move It, which was used to move large files. It got hacked by a group of hackers last year, and what they actually did was, rather than go and exploit the hack, they just sat there and got all the data. Just one of the organizations that was using that to move large files was one of the three largest payroll bureaus in the UK, and they were acting for a third. And just Google Move It hack compensation, and you'll find a whole load of lawyers come up. My point being, you kind of need, so the argument is, and I'm working on something to help the industry with this, but the argument is you really need to properly understand your every tech company you use. You need to know their cyber policy. We probably need the same thing now for zero, in terms of zero trust, to have a clear statement from them, from AI suppliers as well. Paul, do you want to come in and talk a bit about your experience and some of the practical approaches you've taken to your due diligence as you're looking at AI tools, which you've been doing extensively across your business, have you not?
Yeah, we have, to be fair. I mean, we just to reiterate sort of like Howard's point, the data protection is the absolute key, right? At the end of the day, the AI tool is going to be using your data. If your data's not that good, the AI tool output's just going to be incorrect, simple as that. So what we've done first and foremost is we brought in an addendum to the data protection policy just for AI tool usage. Quite open with people experimenting. ChatGPT is out there now, Copilot is out there now, plugged into all sorts of Microsoft tools. You've got Google Bard out there as well. They've just launched a new one called Gemini. So that they're starting to just be open. And a lot of them are free to use. So the addendum is very much targeted at making sure that no client data, no intellectual property data is put into the actual tools themselves. But financial data for me, so long as it's not traceable back to the individual client, the fact that I've got 10 clients with £1 million and 20 clients with 50 million pounds, and they live in Hertfordshire and they drive Porsches, or they drive, you know, they live in Scotland and they drive sort of like, you know, McCanns or whatever it may be, it's not a problem, right? I've got a Scottish friend on there at the moment. He's bound to have something like a Porsche McCann or something. He lives out in the country. So long as that data is anonymized, I think it's fine, and that's where the policy kicks in. All right, we've got a second string of that then, which is a responsible AI framework we're bringing in. And that framework is literally, it's targeting data security, it's targeting data privacy. And to point Howard's point, it's no different really than a normal software vendor selection. Where is your data being stored? How are you getting your data to move between one continent and another continent? How are you making your decisions? And then you move into the transparency piece. What decisions are you making? What tools are you using? What models are you using to get the tools out? And that's where the responsible framework comes in, because you have to have a way to make sure that it's as bias-free as it can be. And the easiest way of doing that is to bring in human oversight. And I mentioned at the e-conference that it can literally take away, you know, or it can automate up to 80% of the job. But that 20% of the job then essentially is the oversight of that, making sure that what's being output is still correct. And it's not just a box ticking exercise. I mean, you can use other tools for that. You can use the output from one tool versus the output of another tool and compare the two together, you know, because at the end of the day, it's very unlikely they're both going to fill in the blanks in the same way, as Ian put it earlier about making things up. So you've got that sort of level of monitoring as well. And we're looking at all of that with the actual sort of responsible AI framework. So we're not looking at building tools, but it's the same thing really if you're going out and buying third parties. It's, you know, think of it as a proper due diligence on a vendor. Why did you choose Microsoft? Why did you choose UniPass? Where's the data stored? How protected is it? How protected are you if there's a problem? It's basic information, really, basic stuff.
I think on that particular point, it kind of comes back to be very aware. If you're being given something for free, yeah, the chances are it's not going to be providing the level. You know, why are they giving it to you for free? Could it possibly be because they want all of your data to train their models on? Yeah. As Howard pointed out, I mean, again, if you think of a classic example, how many times have we all been in a situation where you'll be having a conversation with somebody one day, and you've got your phone on your side, you're talking to a friend. The next day, you start seeing images that directly relate to that. Virtually every app you download from the App Store will have buried deep, deep in it somewhere that you are consenting to them listening to every word you say. And you know, that's embedded in virtually everything. That there are moves, I believe it's by the EU actually, to block that. And there are similar things, I think, going on in the US. But, you know, that is a classic example. Absolutely need to know if you're using anything for free. Well, you need to know, period, where any data is being kept. There has come a question from Andy Boyd that I'd actually like to go to Howard. Are we in any way responsible for where our AI is accessing data from? I think the answer is yes, isn't it? But
the answer is yes. Next question, please. Absolutely, you are. Obviously, there's two things here. Obviously, you are responsible for what happens to your data, but also you are also responsible if you have an AI tool, what that does. So you know, it's like I am responsible for what I say and do, and I'm also responsible if you have company cars, for example. That you are responsible ultimately as a business leader if your company cars are misused and abused by your staff. So it's the same argument. If you're teaching it, training an AI tool, and it's gathering data which you have no legal basis for processing, you're breaching GDPR straight away. So, and it's quite.
I was just about to say that, you know, there's a lot of lawsuits going on at the moment where obviously a lot of these models now are using, you know, existing artists' work and existing sort of like copywriters' work.
Yeah.
And it's a similar process there. They're literally they're scraping information from the internet, which is, let's face it, a lot of the time correct, but in, you know, probably 20% of the case, it's just completely made up. Wikipedia, say no more. Yeah. So yeah, obviously, right. Absolutely spot on, Howard, 100%.
So yeah. Let's move on. And I can almost feel a number of people sitting on this call sort of feeling, do I really want to get involved in this? You know, hang on a minute, isn't this a big, bad, scary place? And the answer is, actually, it is a big, bad, scary place, but it's also wonderful. It can be a wonderful place. So let's talk for a moment, I think, about what are the risks of doing nothing. I'm going to put a benefit on the table. The CEO of JP Morgan Chase came out a couple of months ago and said, by the way, businesses that use AI can probably start to think about giving their staff a 3.5-day week. Conversely, so the point is, you potentially can work a lot less. I mean, I think we should be looking seriously. I'm a big fan of the idea of a 3.5-day week. I actually believe we'll get there at some point. But quite seriously, coming back to risk of doing nothing, what potentially would happen?
I'll pick this one up, mate. Slightly off subject, Andy Burnham, who is the mayor of Manchester and a massive fan of HS2, was complaining bitterly this week the fact that HS2 has been, Northern Lakes have been cancelled, and that the West Coast Main Line is full and the M6 is full. I don't disagree. I think they both are, and the service is not good either way. And he's accusing the government of doing nothing about the Northern Powerhouse, which I'm not going to get into the politics of the things. That's not why we're here. But the argument he made was it's the thought of them doing nothing would have a detrimental effect on the economy of the north of England. And I think he's absolutely right. For you guys, if you do nothing, and all of you do nothing, then that's fine. But not all of you are going to do nothing. Some of you are going to do something. Some of you are going to do a lot. And the benefits, first of all, if I remember my first pension back in the 80s when I signed for it, and the advisor said, I'll come back to you in 3 weeks with a proposal. 3 weeks? Now today, I want him to come back in 3 hours because I want him to search the whole of the market and get me the best deal and best return that he can or she can. Sorry, being sexist there. So there's an impatience. And of course, he or she who comes back with the deal first has got more chance of getting the business than the one who takes a week or so. So business efficiency, business response times, better customer service. If you don't, your competitors will. And that's the big risk of doing nothing. It's what somebody else does.
There was a quote about 10 years ago, which is often repeated by other people, but it originally came from a lady called Tricia Rothschild, who is formerly the head of pensions at Morningstar, who came out and said, technology won't replace advisors, but advisors using technology will replace advisors who don't. And I think we're increasingly seeing that happen. Borrowing from that, my spin on that is it's not that AI will replace advisors yet, although where AI goes in the more distant future really does get fascinating. But advisors using AI will substantially either replace advisors not using it or work an awful lot less. Paul, can I just come back to you to clarify a point? Because Jonathan Stubbs has said in the chat, and I think Jonathan might have slightly misunderstood what you were saying.
Certainly.
Do you want to come up on that point? You see it there.
What I'm basically saying is the fact that you don't need personally identifiable data to go into a ChatGPT, into an LLM. If you've got, put a little response on there, if you've got Paul Miller from Stafford, you don't necessarily need to upload Paul Miller from Stafford. What you need to upload is Mr. M, Mr. P, Mr. 123, whatever you want to call him, from Stafford. No address in there, no personally identifiable data. No necessarily a date of birth, but he's 56 years old. I'm really old, by the way. Just thought I'd throw that one in there. But he's got a pension. He's got a SIP. He's got an ISA, and you've got particular amounts of money in that. And straight away then, that model that you're looking at knows the basics about the client. They know where they are. They know their age. They know what products they've got. They know what their financial situation is. And you've not given any personal information away whatsoever. So I don't see any detriment to that, to what the AI can bring to the table, because you're looking for insights on your data. Your data insights are going to be, what is my demographic? What is my, how many clients have I got with an ISA? How much have they got? What's their area look like? You might buy data from marketplaces that give you that Stafford is an affluent place, and the average income there is £50,000, and the average house is a three-bed semi.
Well, I'll come to you in a minute on that one. You finish, Paul, and then I'm going to come to Howard. That's but I'm okay. going to add into that debate as well. Go on.
It's one of those. I just don't think that what you're doing is you're allowing the AI to see the amount of data that you want it to see to gain enough insight without giving away the actual track back to the underlying client. So that's the anonymization piece that I was talking about there. Yeah. Go on then, Howard.
What are your thoughts?
I'm going to pick up on one thing that Paul said about buying data. The data broking market, which is currently under investigation by the Information Commissioner, do not do it is the simple answer to this. And I'll now tell you why. I should only take half an hour doing this. The simple answer is they say it's consented data. So, but what's it consented to? Does it want to receive information about mortgages, pensions, SIPs, whatever? They might be consented to receive information on forklift trucks or combine harvesters, for all we know. It isn't consented data. There's no way a data broker can ring up, let's say you want to buy 2,500 contacts in Stafford, who all support Stafford Rangers and have all got incomes north of 50,000 quid and own properties of £250,000 or greater. Okay, good profile. You want 1,500 of those. Don't tell me the data broker is going to ring all 1,500 to confirm they'd like to hear from Paul Miller, because it's not going to happen. So the answer is do not do it.
That's an interesting one, Paul, because there are a number of AI systems emerging that, for example, on a fact find, you know, you give the client, you put some basic detail in, and the system will then go and source and pre-populate data from a very wide range of sources, so that you can present it to the client and invite them to say, this is who we think you are. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a tough one for me, really, because of the fact that I like the idea of getting insights about the area that my clients live in. And we're getting those insights ourselves. We're taking our anonymized data and we're looking at, right, okay, we're looking at people who live in Stafford. How many clients have they got? What is their demographic? How many children have they got? What size house have they got? What car do they drive? What job do they do? And I think that level of anonymized data for me, if it's trustworthy, and again, to Howard's point, it probably isn't a lot of the time, but if it's trustworthy, it's massive insights.
There's yeah? probably also for a separate debate, conversation about the whole concept of data for good, because you know people get worried about the abuse of data. But again, if you look at some of you, well those of you who've been to our Empowering Advice Through Technology conference in 23 and 22 and 20 will have seen a friend of mine called Robert Kirk, who runs the most amazing business called Intergen Data. It is, and is literally a worldwide authority on the use of AI in financial advice, and has built a business that can produce incredible predictive analytics for people's future life events. They can now map 95 life events, you know, and are able to take data and give people really powerful insights into what's going to happen in the future of their lives. Has the potential actually to transform financial planning.
Can I just pick up on one more point?
Yeah,
Jonathan's put an interesting one there, because we're looking at client meeting recordings at the moment, and off the back of EAT, we're talking to Planner Pal at the moment. We're having a little bit of a back and forth, but we'll probably get there over the coming weeks or probably a month or two. And Jonathan's point there is very interesting about the fact that when you start recording client meetings, it becomes a lot harder to redact information. Okay. Now it is absolutely very difficult to redact information, and I'm imagining that is one of the points we've already brought back to Planner Pal about the fact that, can I take information out of recordings and would I want to? But it's very, very keen about, or very key, should I say, about the fact that, do I definitely want to take out redact information from transcriptions? Yeah. Now that's obviously a slightly different thing, because a recorded piece is stored on your cloud and wherever else. The transcription, that's got a potential to go elsewhere. I mean, the recording's got a potential to go elsewhere as well. But it's a very interesting point about the fact that do you make recordings now? Do you store the recordings now? They're stored on the cloud with your CRM on your client. You know, you're not really going to be able to redact part of that recording unless you go through it literally. Want for a better frame.
Well, but
frame, frame got, by frame.
You have got businesses like RecordSure and Aveni,
yeah, exactly,
who are actually doing things where they've created AI tools that will pick out certain topics that they know have a regulatory impact, so that you know to actually make sure if certain phrases are used, it flags it from compliance purposes, so you can go and listen to the call. Yeah. I mean, I can think of a very large advice firm in the protection industry who have been recording their calls for about the past 5 years. And one of the benefits, they say, is if they ever get a complaint, the complaint is solved. Could you just call up the recording and you listen to it? And it's like, well, yeah, either we were right or the client was right. Get it out of the way.
And that just comes down to where it's stored and how securely it's stored. You know, putting it out of use of unpermissioned and people without access to it.
Yeah,
I think. Sorry, just to very quickly.
No, go on, Hal.
Just on my point of view, there needs to be a policy around this. Why are we recording client meetings? What is the point? And that then becomes your purposefulness usage. So we are recording this that in the event of a claim being made where he said, she said, we can go back and listen to the recording. And if that is the limit, as you've set, and by the way, that would be my guidance, then you can't do it. You can't really ask AI to listen to it, unless, of course, you've told the client AI is going to listen to the call.
And that's the key.
And that's the key. So again, you need to set out in a policy, which would also probably affect the privacy notice on your website, as to what you do with recorded calls. And you can't vary from it. You must stick to it. Otherwise, if you start trying to redact, and I know there's good technologies to do it, imagine it goes all the way through the cycle, you end up in court, and they bring in a video, an expert witness who's a video expert, and says, is this a true record, or has it been tampered with in some way? And then suddenly the whole recorded call is no longer admissible as evidence. And your solicitor's got his head in his hands and is weeping as he leaves the court. So just be a bit careful there.
Okay, I'd like to come on, because we did have a good supply of questions that came in before the event, and I'm going to try and get through as many as I can. And any I can't, we'll try and find a way of getting, and they'll give us some FAQs for a future event. So the first one I'm going to come to is, somebody asked, is the certificate of in ethical AI from the CISI worthwhile? I've had a look at it. Looks quite interesting. Haven't done it yet myself, but it's kind of on my to-do list. So I like the way they've put it together. Personally, I think that's worth having a look at. Another one, which Paul's got, I'll come to Paul on this in a minute, and then I'd like to add on it. But how do we work together to use AI in a way that minimises job displacement in the advice industry? Do you want to go first, Paul, and then I'll add my two, Penneth?
It's a tough one at the moment, but for me, I think a lot of it's just about collaboration. It's about getting your staff on board, you know, getting their hearts and minds sorted. So we're going down a very similar, we're going down a very easy route of, we've got an AI working group. That AI working group are involved in the decisions that get made, so they can see the impact, they can see the benefits, they can see the impact of what the AI tool can do. So that to me is the easiest way of doing it. That will generate the use case will have a return on investment, and then straight away there's a buy-in straight away from the staff that it's going to affect. And that's actually what we're doing in-house right now.
I think I would just add to that, and sorry, Howard, did you want to come in on that? You're on mute, Howard.
No, sorry, I was just typing aggressively, so don't worry about me. I wasn't waving at you, sorry.
Typing passionately, sir. Excellent, excellent. My point is, we're not going to get away from the fact that, and this is not about financial advice, this is something I want to stress so much to the industry. The industry went through the fifth industrial revolution, which was basically the World Wide Web and mobile devices, relatively unaltered. That is not going to happen this time. We are talking about the sixth industrial revolution, and it will affect absolutely all knowledge workers, not just financial advisors. It'll affect lawyers, it'll affect compliance officers, it'll affect consultants. The question now is no longer how much you know, but how well you can ask the question of various intelligences to get the best possible outcome. That is going to happen across all knowledge industries. There was Professional Power Planner put a great headline on something which I'm going to borrow, which is they put it up saying, was artificial intelligence the spinning jenny for the Power Planner? It's the spinning jenny for all knowledge industries. But what you can do to guarantee, I've been saying this especially to Power Planners for most of the last year, but I would say, you know, anybody working in advice business, the most employable people in the next decade are going to be the people that can get the most out of technology. So if you want to make sure you are the last person that is given their P45, become the best person using tech within the business. I've been speaking to many advice firm owners and CEOs in recent months, and you know, I did a conference the week actually where for a firm. For their annual conference, and as I was saying that to their assembled power planners, the CEO and the ops director were both nodding curiously when I suggested that, well, you know, the best person in using IT was going to be the last person fired. So, you know, the way that we address this, and it will give us opportunities to do far more interesting things. But if you think your job is going to stand still, you're going to be in for a terrible shock. And we are doing, you know, again, something I'm working on at the moment is looking at what are the basic what are the new qualifications that particularly paraplanners should be looking to take around, you know, we're saying to a lot of paraplanners, become data experts, because again, Paul, I think you'll bear me out, there's no shortage of need for data experts in the advisor business of tomorrow, is there?
Not at all, Ian.
Let's go to more questions.